Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down.
We're going to rock and roll here. Hello, everybody. This is Harvey Sluggo Wasserman back for the 72nd, I count them 72nd, grassroots Emergency Election Protection Coalition gathering.
Sure.
It is November 15th, and we are going to go 90 minutes, as we always do. And then we need you to please mute your four-letter words. You can say darn and heck, but not the seven dirty words as laid out by George Carlin. We have, as always, a really full agenda today. We're going to give the first 5 minutes, opening 5 minutes, to Francesco Da Vinci to talk very quickly about his book. He's going to show some pictures, but remember, Francesco, we're on the radio. So we're then going to jump in, and Joel Siegel is going to talk to us about what's at the top of everybody's agenda, which is the John Lewis voting rights bill. They're saying now that Manchin and Sinema are for it, but will not go around the filibuster. You know, will wonders never cease. So who can make this stuff up? So at any rate, Joel is the master of congressional intrigue, and he is going to talk to us about what's going on with the John Lewis Act. And then we're going to do a deep, deep dive on the environment, the COP meeting, which has come to an end, the breakthrough that Biden and Xi are actually talking to each other. What a concept that the heads of the two biggest countries in the world would actually speak. And we also, Wendy, you have brought someone into the call who's doing some really interesting legal work in Florida. And what is his name, Wendy?
It's Chuck O'Neill, and he's with the Florida Rights and Nature Network and the FL5 group. So Chuck O'Neill, he's really awesome.
So we're looking for him to come on the call. So basically, we're going to do this deep dive, and we really need to take action on the John Lewis Act. We're really down to the wire here. We do apparently have 51 senators willing to vote for it, but something's got to happen in between. So we'll get to Joel Siegel on that in 5 minutes, and then we're going to do a whole lot on the climate. If anyone else has something they want to add to the agenda, please do it to me in the chat, and we'll see what we come up with. Tatanka, you especially, we want you to talk to us a bit about the environment and the interconnection with the indigenous. Next week is November 22nd. None of the rest of you are old enough to remember November 22nd, 1963. But next week, we will do a deep dive into the Kennedy assassination and other conspiracies that we know actually happened. I will tell you, as a historian, that the odds that Lee Oswald, I never call him Lee Harvey, by the way, that Lee Oswald killed John Kennedy are zero. But we'll take that up next week, along with a whole lot of other stuff contemporary to our election protection and environmental protection agenda. Okay, so if you have something else you want to discuss, I see Chuck is on the call, so we'll get to him momentarily after we do Tatanka's, Mr. Da Vinci's presentation, and then Joel's. Okay, everybody good? We got an agenda here? Okay, let's rock and roll. Francesco Da Vinci, you have written a book called I Will Not Kill. We had you on briefly last week, and you were so good. We wanted to have you back. We're going to give you 5 minutes. Your pictures are keyed up with Steve, who's our chief engineer today. We're being engineered by Steve Caruso. We will be joined in a while by Mike Hirsch. But Da Vinci, go ahead. Your 5 minutes of fame are now.
All right. Well, thank you for having me on the show, Harvey. It's a great service you're providing. And the whole purpose of my new book is to pay tribute to conscientious objectors to war. They haven't been recognized in a positive way. So this book honors conscientious objectors and takes us through the whole 60s decade. I kept the journal for 11 years. And this is all about honoring COs and encouraging nonviolent activism we can do more than we think we can do.
Okay, very good. Well, you know what they say, if you remember the 60s, you weren't there, but obviously you were. And you and I were born on exactly the same day, December 31st, 1945. So go for it here.
That's right.
Cover of your book, I Refuse to Kill. And this is you with some doves.
Yes, that's right. Okay. So the book has been, I'm proud to say, endorsed by Noam Chomsky, who said, you know, it's time also we recognize the saving grace of the Vietnam War, and that is the conscientious objectors that opposed that war and stood for nonviolence.
Good, absolutely. Well, my contention, you know, people look for the root of why people, the Americans are so rude to each other and why there's no trust in this country anymore. And I related directly to the years where Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon got in front of the world and completely lied day after day after day. I think that's really the touch point of disintegration of this country.
You're in the shot.
Go ahead, Francesco.
Yes. Also, I wanted to mention that my generation felt very deceived. And in the beginning, with the inauguration of President Kennedy, I attended his inauguration when I was 15 years old and took pictures of it. And John Kennedy, as you know, addressed specifically my generation and told us to do what we could do to make the country better. And one of the quotes that I love that came later from JFK was that war is not inevitable. You know, we've been brainwashed with this attitude that, oh, this is the norm, you know, these wars all around the world. And I guess we're showing pictures now. So let me start with the first one here. I guess whoever's, is somebody operating this now?
Yes, Steve.
Okay, well, that the first image on top there, that's the picture I took as a teenager overlooking Pennsylvania Avenue. And that's JFK and Jacqueline sitting next to him.
Okay.
Yeah. Then the next one, the Cuban Missile Crisis. Like I said, we go through all the 60s. And this was the first big alarm, you know, the danger of the nuclear weapons and the proliferation and the danger of Armageddon. Okay. So that's it. I took this in my high school. This is only about 1,000 days JFK served. And this is a week later after the assassination, and you can see all the thousands of people that stood in line. And this is 1 week later.
This is a very long line in Washington, D.C. in the snow, and we're seeing a military guy over a gravesite.
Arlington National Cemetery.
Right. And by the way, for those of you who don't know, Arlington National Cemetery was originally the homestead of Robert E. Lee.
Exactly right.
Took it away from him in the Civil War, gratefully, thankfully.
Go ahead. This is my portrait of Rosa Parks, December 1st, 1955. She refuses to go to the back of the bus and became an icon internationally for civil and human rights. The next one is Bobby Kennedy. I attended as a 17-year-old. I managed to attend the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City in 1964. And while I was walking to the convention, we spontaneously ran into his car. He got out. This is Kennedy style. He gets on top of the roof of the car to talk to us, and he encouraged us to get involved like JFK did.
Good.
The next one, this is my best buddy served in Vietnam. And you know how divisive things are now, Harvey Sluggo. And this is my best buddy, and we exchanged letters from Vietnam, and he wrote to me. I was at the University of Maryland, and I stood as a conscientious objector, and his beliefs were a military, the way to peace. And we disagreed, and the letters are in the book. The next one is, this is the first big national march against the war. You know, Johnson and Nixon were always saying, oh, these people, they're only a few troublemakers that are against the war. But once we came out into the streets, this is October 21st, 1967, then it couldn't be denied. There were 100,000 people out on the bridge from the Lincoln Memorial marching to the Pentagon. And so there it was obvious the tide was turning finally.
I was at that march. I was actually in a wheelchair because I'd been beaten up the day before at a march in Chicago.
Terrible.
And there's Muhammad Ali.
And Muhammad Ali was also a conscientious objector. Finally, in 19, he took the case to the Supreme Court. He faced 5 years in prison, which is what I faced too. And we both won our cases the same year, 1971. But and this is a picture when I got to meet him, the champ, and thank him for his team.
Muhammad Ali. You, however, did not knock out Sonny Liston. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. And then this is President Kennedy and Senator Eugene McCarthy. As you know, the two main peace candidates that had the courage to go against the war, McCarthy was the first. He asked Bobby to do it. Bobby wasn't ready. But shortly after, when McCarthy did so well in New Hampshire, Bobby jumped into the race. There was a division in my own personal life because my girlfriend supported McCarthy. I supported Bobby Kennedy. But we didn't care who won it as long as it was one of the peace candidates.
Okay.
And these were my role models, Gandhi, Einstein, Dr. King, and I would add Cesar Chavez.
I would say that Einstein has the best hair.
Okay. And this next one here is a poignant moment. If you can see here, the woman standing on the podium here, she's reading the names of the war dead. And this was my induction call. And I was so moved when I came to the induction to declare my conscientious objection that right away I called for my refusal of induction. And my lawyer, draft lawyer, said, this is going to really bump up your jail time. Please go back in. But I refused to go back in. And I took that stand. This is who is my best friend for 20 years, Neil Armstrong. And I followed the space race on the side. And, you know, when people talk about priorities, and they're worried about a little too much money in the space program, whatever, you know, the weapons of mass destruction that we're building, that's really where we ought to go first, in my view, and turn our priorities around. And, you know, we have so many needless. We can end on this. This is my meeting Neil, and then the first time I met him, and then we became best buddies for 20 years. And then, again, like Jerry, we had political differences, but still, you know, reconciliation was the spirit of the friendship.
Good for you. Good for you. Neil Armstrong was from a small town in Ohio. And
Wapakoneta.
Wapakoneta. Very good. And there's a film about him called First Man.
That's right.
I'm not sure it really does him justice.
Right. I agree. So
thank you for that. If you, Steve, you can put the cover, there it is.
Well, thank you very much for that.
Francesco da Vinci, you don't paint, do you? Okay, never mind. Okay, so we have three quick questions, and then we're going to move on. Thank you so much for that, Francesco.
If somebody gets the book, I wanted to let them know we're having a December 11th event in Westwood Village, the first signing and everything, and we're going to brainstorm about nonviolent action, taking nonviolent action at the individual level, and get America on that level too.
Okay, Lynn, Jeffrey, and Mary, and then real quickly, please, and then we're gonna go to Joel. See you.
Yeah, I just wanted
very
to
very good,
say,
Francesco.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I just wanted to say thanks to Francesco for the presentation, and also I urge everyone to see Judith Ehrlich's great movie called The Boys Who Said No, and
right.
It would accompany perfectly Francesco's book, and I suggest you all ought to work together.
You know, if you can get a hold of her, we'd have her on. So let me know if we can contact her. Mary, and then
thank you for that.
Jeffrey, and then Myla. Mary, real quick, Mary Butler Stonewall. All right, you're muted. There you go, Mary. Go
I'm
ahead.
Here.
Real quickly, please.
Real quickly, I wanted to say that I was aware that Kennedy was actually trying to pull out of Vietnam and didn't
yes.
want us to go into the Vietnam thing. And when he was assassinated, then the vice president went ahead gung-ho for Vietnam.
Yes.
And then I wanted to know your opinion. I wanted to know your opinion on the fact that our government realized as long as we can have the continuous war tax, that disaster consumerism has
you're
taken over America's politics, that
okay.
they realize they can make more money and control the people through disaster. So if we're at war
okay.
or in a disaster situation, we as the people lose more rights. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mary. I do want to say that Kennedy had sent 11,000 troops into Vietnam, but he signed a memo explicitly saying that the troops would all come home in early 1965. He wanted them there during his election, but then he was going to pull them out. There's no doubt about that. Jeffrey Barkdale, real quick, and then Myla.
All right. First, two things real quick. Can you hear me?
Yes, hurry up, please.
All right, two things. One, did you get that little message, Harvey?
Yes. And then what else?
And secondly, this is for you. This is for you, Francisco, about that peace protest. I think I can help out with that.
I have a video
in my possession that I found on Instagram. I downloaded it and or reposted it. I got the copy of the thing. And I can share with you if I can just have your email.
Okay, put it in the chat. Thank you very much. Amaiwa and
email, right?
Thank you, Jeffrey. Amaiwa and Tatanka.
Francesco, what wonderful photos. How great it was for you to be able to be there and to photograph those iconic figures and events.
Thank you.
I just wanted to know if you would repeat, you're coming to Westwood, California.
Oh, thank you very much for that.
It's in my neck of the woods, and I'm wondering.
It's December 11th at Meet Fresh, the cafe in Westwood near UCLA. And if anybody has questions, they can just go irefusetokill.com.
Can you post the information about that in the chat? About the
I think
new
Pluggo has a page for that.
We'll put it in chat there if you can. And we'll also post it at the website.
Thank you so much. I'll
look for it and see if I can put it in the
chat.
Wonderful to see you there.
Wonderful. Thank you.
And Tatanka.
Yeah, thank you, Francesco. And I want to underscore for people to look at the boys who said no. Great shots of David Harris, Joan Baez, Mark Rudd, Daniel Ellsberg, Martin Luther King, Muhammad Ali, et cetera. I want to say that I'm friends with Judith. I helped film that, and I was also interviewed for The Boys Who Said No. So I can give her a call, Sluggo. I know she's still in Australia, but it doesn't matter with Zoom. We can connect.
Right. Well, we'll have to adjust our hours. But yes, be glad to have her on and we can show a short thing of the film as we've shown pictures from Francesco. Dorothy Reich, you always got to mute yourself. Unmute yourself, Dorothy.
I think I heard an interview with her. I think it was Robert Scheer did it.
Podcast.
And we can get that film. And all right, we'll do a showing with PDA or something, or PDSMM, or, you know.
All right, that would
be
great.
You can show it. You can do a Zoom showing. You share your screen and you can show the whole movie. And it probably wouldn't cost that much to get it.
All right, we will do that. Absolutely. Okay, The Boys Who Said No. Thank you, Francesco. It's been a pleasure to have you both weeks. I hope you'll continue to join our calls. We're really glad to have you on, okay?
Thank you.
And I'll get the book, and Art Levine has said that he was both at the Pentagon and at the Chicago Convention. You know, that's the big duo there. The question was, I was actually in a wheelchair when we went to the Pentagon. I had been beaten up at the Chicago. I was stupid enough to go back to Chicago and got whacked again. So there you go. All right, you guys, everybody, thank you so much. That's the root. And I will say that's the root of our problems. And I will say that nothing has done more to warp the American society than the war in Vietnam. And to hear these two so-called presidents lying to us day after day after day after JFK had been shot. And we will talk next week about the assassination as we move ahead. Okay, thank you so much. We're gonna go now to our man on Capitol Hill, Joel Siegel, the great activist. And no one knows more about the workings of Congress than Joel Siegel. So Joel, can you update us on the all important John Lewis bill, what is happening and what can we do about it? Because we don't intend to sit passively by, as Francesco did not sit passively by. We need to deal with the realities here. So, Joel, what can you tell us?
Hello, everybody. I had a great weekend. Went to the mountains, and I played bass with my new funk rap band. So I'm in a very good mood right now.
tell us how we're going to win the John Lewis Voting Acts bill.
I can't use the curse word. Let me deal with some of the policy, then I'll talk about how I think we can win it. So first of all, in terms of Harvey had a very brilliant idea about using executive order, that Biden would issue an executive order to reinstate preclearance from the 65 Civil Rights Voting Act. I'm going to read you the definition of an executive order. It's a signed, written, and published directive from the President of the United States that manages operations of the federal government. Executive orders are not legislation. They require no approval from Congress, and Congress cannot simply overturn them. That's definitions are very, very, very important. Could Biden issue an executive order? Yes. Would the Republicans then issue a suit in the Supreme Court? Yes. My argument would, I think he should do it, and I'll tell you why. Two reasons. One, his polls are horrible, and I think his numbers would shoot up. Number two, he shows the Black community that he didn't take them for granted because they were the ones who, the Black community got Biden elected and made sure the Senate was, you know, a majority Democrat. Also, it takes time for a lawsuit to go, you know, to the Supreme Court. The analogy that I would use is just as Lyndon Baines Johnson basically through an executive order got the National Guard to move George Wallace out of the way of the University of Alabama University when they were blocking black students. Gotta mute. I don't see the difference. If you're barring black people in the 50s, right? From entering a college, then what's the difference between that and barring black people from voting? I don't see the difference at all. I don't see any difference. So I think, you know, that to me would be the reason for an executive order. Furthermore, under the Constitution, the federal government has the final say on voting. Number three is the 65 Civil Rights Act is still on the books. The preclearance provision was gutted, but if you bring for example, Section 2 of 65 Civil Rights Act is where the action is. So I spoke to senior level official at the Judiciary Committee, and I said, well, what about the DOJ? Can they bring lawsuits under Section 2 against all these states? And he says, yes, they can do it, and they are doing it. And I said, well, are they doing it where everybody knows about it? He said, no. I said, well, why doesn't the DOJ just issue as many lawsuits as you can, especially with the states where they're doing it with surgical precision, and just say, you know, we're not going to allow you to implement these laws. It's still not so easy, but those lawsuits, you know, are happening. Then I asked about a carve out filibuster. And apparently, and I was wrong, Manchin and Sinema apparently are opposed to the carve out of the filibuster. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what I think might be the strategy, you know, to deal with that. My conclusion is the same conclusion that I reached last time we met. We have to go back to the strategies of the anti-Vietnam War movement, the civil rights movement. And even, I don't like to use the word the NRA, but you don't ever see the NRA march. They don't have to march. They have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who call members of Congress and scare them to the point where they, you know, they're afraid to pass a law that might hurt them. I do think there's going to have to be black entertainers, white dignitaries, white entertainers, street protests, national call-in days. I do think we should organize a series of national call-in days to Sinema's office and to Manchin, calling for a special carve-out of the filibuster. I asked the Judiciary Committee, can you go to the Rules Committee and change the rules for a filibuster? The answer was no. So there's all these like machinations and all that stuff. Then I talked about reconciliation. Could you put a budget like $20,000 or $20 million budget for the SBI or the FBI to monitor elections? And because that's when you can do reconciliation, when you have an actual amount of money attached to the bill. And his answer was that it's not an appropriations bill. And I didn't want to disagree with him because I want to keep a good relationship. I didn't want to get in a fight with one of my best colleagues. I don't agree with that. As long as you affix a number to a bill, that is an appropriations request. So in my opinion, everything I said, I think we should try all the above. I'll close by saying, what does Biden have to lose by issuing an executive order? He's not going to lose the black vote. His popularity would go up. He'll make an issue that's a non-issue into a major issue. And I think that he should try it, but street heat and sweet heat, it's going to be the only way to do this. The only reason why Johnson passed the 64 and 65 Civil Rights Act was because he told King, make me do it. And they did the street heat and the sweet heat, and it worked. And I believe we're going to have to go back to those tactics. That's it. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I have a quick, as a history professor, I have a quick quiz here. Who can get the right answer? What was the most powerful and most important executive order ever issued in the United States history? And this is not a matter of opinion.
Good or bad?
It was good. It was the most important positive executive order ever issued in American history.
Emancipation Proclamation.
That's exactly right. Who said that?
I think two people did. One of them is Eric.
Okay, well, you get a free trip to Starbucks, so let me know.
A free trip to sunny Aruba.
Sunny Aruba, as opposed to sunny Corleone. So, yes, it was the Emancipation Proclamation. It was an executive order. If you've seen the movie Lincoln, the reason that Lincoln went to get the 13th Amendment was because he didn't think an executive order would hold up over time. But in this case, it is absolutely essential that that Biden issue an executive order. I don't know why he won't do it. And I think people, this is nonpartisan. I think people on the call, we should brainstorm about how to force this to happen. I'm tired. I was sick and tired of listening to those two names from Arizona and West Virginia. Art Levine, you got a hand. What do you got, Art?
Yeah, well, first of all, I did some interviewing with Norm Ornstein for potential article, this is consistent with his public, Ornstein's interviews, that Manchin, at least, has shown some bend on the issue of, or hinting, regard. I know that doesn't take away anything that's been said about the notion of the standing filibuster, as opposed, you know, with the standing filibuster plus carve-out, meaning that you'd have to come up with, you flip it on the head the way it works now, or talking filibuster, and that he had shown some interest in it. So I just want to mention that. But Sinema's is big unknown on that. None of what you're talking about is negated by that. The second thing is when Joel is talking about John Lewis, what about the Freedom to Vote Act? Is that just assumed to be part of the same conversation? Or where does that stand? Or that's dead meat? Or what's going on with that and pressure or openness to filibuster on that? What's your take on that, Joel?
That's a good question, Art, as always. All your questions are always excellent. That does have a possibility of passing. It's just that, I mean, even if Manchin says, you know, yes, let's move forward on it, it's going to be filibustered. So,
right. So the filibuster is sort of central, and the window that was slightly open. Now, the thing is that I don't understand is there is this group that PDA is part of, and others, the Declaration for American Democracy, the big large organization that's, you know, has a large coalition. What I'm a little unclear about is while there's been some national efforts, obviously, and protests in Washington, I have seen little, and please tell me if I'm wrong, of large-scale grassroots, at least people involved, even if nationals get involved, like coalition here, in Arizona and in West Virginia, and, you know, a grassroots campaign in those states buffeted by large-scale ad spending to kind of motivate, you know, door-to-door grassroots and phone-in from the constituents in Arizona and West Virginia. Is that missing, as it seems to me to be missing? And why can't a group like large-scale group with money and funding, like the people in the Coalition for American Democracy, do anything about that?
Arthur, can I answer that?
Yes.
Please, Joel, go ahead.
All right. Everyone, if you get a chance, look at the chat and look what Mike Fox of PDA, and for those of you who do not know Mike Fox, everybody should know Mike Fox. He's one of my personal heroes. He didn't pay me to say this. I've never even met Mike really yet, but I have so much respect for him. What Mike's doing is what we all should be doing. Mike is organizing street heat, getting people arrested in DC. There have been actions in Arizona and West Virginia. I think though the larger question would be, how do we maximize participation? And what PDA and all these other groups have been doing in Arizona and West Virginia. And instead of having 100 people getting arrested, what if we had a few thousand people getting arrested? And clearly the reason why Harvey and I and Mike and so many people on this call felt strongly about the need for one unified progressive umbrella, which we still don't have, because America, I am sorry to say this, we're a bunch of cowboys. We have a cowboy mentality, a frontier mentality of radical individualism. We have to participate in the NPAC. We'll have a meeting. I think we're doing it at the end of the, we have a end of the week. If we do not unite and really have a serious conversation, not platitudes, not for 20 minutes where I sit here and talk about the need for unity, I'm talking about a serious, radical movement. Radical means to get to the root. The radical problem in this country is the right wing is unified and the left and progressives are disunified, fragmented, too many leaders that are egomaniacal, but PDA and others are setting the stage, but they can't do it by themselves. We need a unified movement and a unified strategy meeting. I have not been invited. I organized the first, Harvey and I organized the first congressional hearings on voter suppression. Correct, Harvey?
Yeah, in 2004.
Okay.
You had a lot more hair back then.
I had a hell of a lot of hair. I'm sorry. I had a lot of hair back then. If I have not been invited, a former senior congressional staffer to John Conyers, his former senior advisor for over 20 years, to a strategy call, there's something wrong with that picture. Now, it's not about me. It's about all these other great minds and talents. We need one call every week to deal with the John Lewis Act, or we're not going to win this thing. It's just called unity. That's it. Thanks.
Question I asked wasn't, is there any big TV ad spending on this issue in West Virginia and Arizona?
I don't know.
Not that I know of.
Okay, why so not?
I think Joel has something here. We should organize a national call like we did with the National Justice Coalition with all the major heavy hitters. And Joel, you know most, and Art, you know quite a few, and set a strategy for getting this through. We can start with an executive order. We need a carve out. It's gonna go to the Supreme Court and John Roberts is gonna decide whether to reverse his decision from the 2013 Shelby case. That's what it's gonna come down to. And at least in part, but we have to have a mass movement to get this thing going. So I think we need to strategize. Joel, we need to have another call. Doesn't have to be 5 hours. But, another
national that's for sure.
But we need action on this. We can't let this go by. And Art, thank you. You brought up the other bill, which
thank you, Art. Important.
We have 60 people on the call, 61 actually. Justin LeBlanc and then Dorothy Reich.
So correct me if I'm wrong, Joel. My understanding about the reconciliation is that you have a limited number of bills that you can put through in any given time frame. So perhaps one of the things along with the street heat and sweet heat we can put in here is that certain things are more critical than others. And you have organizations that are ready to stand up on these particular issues. If they want to actually pass them, then you need to get aligned with these particular groups so that you have that heat in order to have the cover to pass your bill.
That's called good trouble. Mm-hmm. You know, listen, if John Conyers, may he rest in peace, he would have already done this. We would have already had strategy meetings in his Judiciary Committee room, national phone calls. But Conyers, who was trained by Martin King and was King's lawyer, he viewed himself as an extension of Martin King and used to wear the Rainbow Coalition pin because Conyers understood the intersection of grassroots power and passing legislation. I hate to say this, but a lot of these very well-intentioned members of Congress are afraid of the grassroots, won't bring them in. That's why I got in a lot of trouble all the time with Mr. Conyers' staff. They were a little bit uncomfortable, not the Judiciary Committee. But if we got to try reconciliation, do it. Executive order, do it. The Democrats have to get as fierce as Mitch McConnell, and the grassroots got to get as fierce as the right wing. You can't play nice with these people. They're evil, Jim Crow, racist, secessionist. And for some reason, we don't call them racist. They are racist, Jim Crow secessionists. Now, I just don't think being nice to them is going to, it's not a winning strategy.
Well, right. So there's a lot of bias going on for sure, even in media, right? We want to be both sides-ism on all sorts of things. So let's represent the cities. Let's represent the suburbs. Let's represent the rich. Let's represent the poor. Let's represent the racists. Let's represent the anti-racists, right? And so I think that that's going to be an issue moving forward for sure. But one other group I want to add to the coalition is the movement from pray to pay, meaning the people who are stuck under predatory lending, predatory renting schemes, et cetera, unions giving them organizing power to even use the financial system against itself in order to run union strikes for greater pay. But I'd like to talk to you guys about that stuff later. I just want to throw that out there now.
Thank you, Justin. A lot of strikes going on. We'll get to Wendy Wiederman and then Dorothy Reich. Wendy?
Hi, thank you. Kind of one of my little nebulous, like connect the dot things, talking about the mass arrests. I just wanted to throw this in there. Like I was part of Extinction Rebellion, so I'm all about the direct action. But I think about when I think about like thousands of people getting arrested at once, I flash back to Occupy. With like New York City when they were all just like in the pens, and then all of a sudden we have like more anti-protest laws and just more toys for the police and all that. Just something I think about like strategy-wise, like when we're thinking ahead of how to organize mass demonstrations that involve a lot of people, I do kind of think of like decentralization, like thinking back to Francisco's picture, that woman reading off the names, like it's one person on a street corner, like in addition to boycotts and marketing and all that, but like, what if we had people that were, it's like, instead of having like one group where everyone could just get shot down at once, like what if people were just kind of spread out a little bit? Like, what if we like had like a couple of people on each street corner for like a mile, you know? So it's like, they can't come and just round everybody up like a pin, like just thinking in ways that every time, like we get mass mobilization, they find new ways to suppress it. So I just think that's something to keep in mind.
We have to find new ways to make it more powerful. That's all. It's a chess game, but you're right about that. Thank you, Wendy. Dorothy Reich. And Wendy, Chuck, I'm going to get to Chuck, but it'll probably be after the hour. So Chuck, I hope you can stick with us, please. Talk about the legality. So, okay, Dorothy?
I don't know. It seems the only way Democrats are going to pass the voting rights bill is they are absolutely certain they're going to lose the House. Now, just an article in the New York Times today, Republicans gain heavy House edge in 2022 as gerrymandered maps emerge. That article might do more than all the grassroots organizing that we can put together. The other thing is, you know, Manchin and Sinema were paid to do one thing. And the thing that they were paid to do was to kill BBB. That's what they were paid to do. That's what the pharmaceutical lobby, you know, industry wanted. They figured the easiest way to stop the negotiations on medication and end this, all of this stuff, was just to kill the bills entirely. And that's what they seem to have done, thanks to MBS and inflation due to the oil prices. So they may have actually killed it. I thought it was dead the minute that Pramila folded. So that's it's really sad. It's very sad. I don't know what to say. I don't want to discourage people. I think we have to do everything we can do, but at a certain point, you know, we're just dealing with pure evil.
We are. I do have a piece up today, another one on reader-supported news, rsn.org. Maybe, Steve, you can find the link. I sent it about how the Democrats blew it in Virginia. They refused to deal with the reality of because they're petrified, as Dorothy has pointed out, they're petrified of the progressive left, and they would rather lose than cave into the future.
Dorothy is sleeping, okay? He's taking a nap. We're going to go upstairs in 1 hour. I'm going to check first, okay?
Somebody's got to mute. So, we have to get the Democratic Party to transition to a party of the future, as opposed to the one who loses elections in Virginia because they refuse to do grassroots campaigning. And it's utterly absurd. And in this case, Dorothy...
But Trump won Virginia big time. Grassroots organizing is not going to do anything for Manchin. We're lucky we have a Democrat from Virginia, because if he loses, then we're going to get a Republican. I don't know. What do you think? The people in Virginia the problem with Virginia is that these people don't know anything. They have no communication other than Sinclair and Fox, because everybody has seen to it that they don't have broadband. They don't have access to the internet. They only have access to what comes in over their TV antenna. And that's Sinclair. And that is way far right. Maybe they get OAN, maybe they get Newsmax, but they don't get CNN. They don't get MSNBC. They don't get the internet. They can't read The Intercept. They can't read Truth Out. They can't even read the New York Times. They have no information except what's given to them by the Republicans.
It's up to us. It's up to the Democratic Party to remedy this. We saw in Georgia, of all places, how it could be done.
Georgia has the internet.
Yes.
West Virginia doesn't have the internet. They don't even have roads. Those people can't get out of there. They can't get from one holler to the next.
Okay. Thank you, Dorothy.
It's a sad thing.
Joel Siegel and then Ray Lutz. Joel and then Ray.
In my experience with grassroots organizing, and I remember Andrew Young said this at a Martin Luther King event in Charlotte, North Carolina. When I've been part of movements that had solidarity, they had a plan, they had leaders, they had press, they were unrelenting. We won, didn't get everything that we wanted, but we won every time. If you've got five or six organizations who are asking for people to get arrested, what we need to do is get PDA. We got Mike here. Mike knows the groups. Have those groups that are already organizing sponsor a national emergency symposium and invite all the groups that could be part of what they're already doing. Why reinvent the wheel? Is Mike, are you with us?
Mike Fox, are you on the call? I thought I saw him. But we do have to come up with a strategy. We cannot lose these two bills.
That's the strategy. The strategy is if we know there's several organizations who are getting 100 people arrested, and the way DC works, DC activists are really pretty amazing. I mean, I got arrested in DC. A Reverend Barber called me up after I'm not doing this about me, but I texted him and said, they're gonna gut Obamacare. Let's do a prayer vigil and block McConnell's office. We got 200 people. We all got arrested. And then we kept doing it day after day after day. And McCain put his thumb down. I'm just saying that we can't predict what's going to happen, but I can predict definitively that if we don't do more, then we'll never get that bill passed. But if Mike Fox is on the line, we need to identify the five or six organizations that are getting arrested, and then they need to have a big old open meeting with as many organizations as we can, especially of color, and then come up with a strategy. I'll close by saying we really ought to be winning this. If you look at the Black Lives Matter movement, they were so powerful that Trump had to send the National Guard out on them. I mean, we are in the majority. Progressives and Democrats are in the, if we're in the majority of this country, there is no excuse to be losing this bad. We have to do what Michael Jackson did. We have to look at the man in the mirror, and we have to look at us and go, what is wrong with the progressive movement? And why can't we get it together? Why can't we just work together? And we don't want to answer that question. I don't know why, but isn't it kind of obvious that we've screwed it up, that we're kind of screwed up and we need to change our tactics?
We need to convene a national call on the voting rights bills. Okay, the good news is we have at least 48 Democrats. We have the vice president. The president has to be moved off his tush. Is that a four-letter word? We can use Yiddish, yeah? Do an executive order, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, he can just say he's emulating Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation. Aside from which, he's just reconfirming the Civil Rights Act of 1965. And then we're going to put John Roberts on the spot and see if he's going to repeat the travesty of the Shelby decision. Okay, Ray Lutz.
Okay, thanks a lot, Harvey. I'd like to propose a general approach to this, which is to take a look at specific things in these bills that are going to be important for the people and work it one way or the other. This is, and maybe make stuff up like they do with the, critical race theory, which isn't really being taught, not a big deal, but it's becoming a marching cry. Same thing could be for the left, and this is an example. Save Social Security and Medicare. They want to get rid of it. They want to privatize it all. Well, it may not be exactly true, but I've seen it happen time and again where they try this, and yet we're never on the proactive end of it. So I would say take a look at these bills, see specific things that they're going to either gain or lose in them. I don't think just getting arrested is going to do anything. People are going to look at it and go, oh, these are a bunch of liberal clowns. You're not going to get anywhere with that. You have to get people to understand what they're going to gain or lose from the bills and promote it that way. Thanks.
Thank you. Tatanka?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this call. It's long overdue. At the call, we need to bring in young people. I'll bring in the leader in LA from Sunrise. We need to bring in black and brown organizations. We have to, from the get-go, be the coalition we say we want. And then the actions that you, Sluggo, and Joel been talking about are right on spot, because there has to be some kind of image about a choice. Are we the people, are Martin Luther King? Are we the people of the people that killed Emmett Till, the Bull Connors, the George, whatever, and whatever appeals to the younger generation? This is a pivotal choice time, but we have to have actions that people can support. And this is one thing that people can support. And I'm a big believer, as you know, in the relational grassroots organizing, being a disciple of Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez, where I cut my teeth while I was waiting for the FBI to pick me up for draft resistance. And I'm remembering what RFK Jr. said when he came out to the Delano reunion of the great boycott several years ago in Delano. And he said the last conversation his dad, Robert Kennedy, had with the family before he left to go to California for the California primary, and he was going to spend time with Caesar and Dolores again. And his aide says, why do you have to go see that commie Chavez? And he says, I like Caesar. And then whenever all those other people left, he talked to the kids. He says, why I'm going to California? When they say, why, Daddy? He said, well, National Labor Relations Act, 1935. what did that do? Because they're always doing these quizzes in the Kennedy family. And they said, well, it gave unions the right to organize. Yeah. And what two groups of people were excluded from that act? Farm workers and domestics. He said, the reason I'm going to California is to end slavery in California. That's what the farm workers are. Now, the point of all this is to say that they say that you can't organize Bakersfield and the Central Valley. They call that the Selma of California. And the Dolores Huerta Foundation is very successful getting people on water boards, on school boards, just building up to the city councils, building up to congressional offices by vecinos, by neighbors organizing. It's an old grassroots thing. So we have to do it all. We really have to do it all. And there will be people, nonviolent civil disobedience in the name of a greater strategy that people can understand, like the civil rights movement, is effective, but not just one-offs.
Absolutely. Very well stated. So we have to put our heads together and come up with a date and pull together the kind of coalition we had on the last National Justice Call, where we had 230 people and many more who couldn't get in. This has to be done. It's got to be done soon. So Tataki, you, me, and Joel, maybe we'll put our heads together, come up with a date, and let's do this. It's got to happen soon. Eric, Lazarus, and then Mary. We have 62 people with us.
I seem to be having a little bit of a success very recently working with influencers, people who have at least 100,000 social media followers. Given that, keeping... Putting more progressives in power is critical for fighting climate change, obviously, for democracy. I could go through with people what I've done to get a hold of kind of medium scale influencers, put them on a podcast, put them in this meeting, and then tweet out about this and build up more influence that way. If anybody wants to talk to me about it, I'm Eric L. Lazarus on Instagram. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you. I'm too old to be an influencer, but I'm sure there are many out there who would join us. That'd be great. Mary, and then we're going to start to think about moving on to the climate. So, Mary Butler, real quick.
Being one that's been in and out of protesting and stuff here and there throughout the years, I was wondering if we had one governor from one state that was on board for what we're trying to do with the voter protection, that he, because every state, the National Guard is for each state has their own National Guard, that he would allocate a National Guard battalion to accompany the protesters to protect them from violence. That would make a big statement when the news reports that these National Guard are actually came with the protesters to stand a protection line around them from any undue influence or attack.
I like that. That's a great idea. That's terrific. There are some female governors as well, maybe in Michigan. So we need to, that's, let's find a governor.
I think that would set a better statement than just them coming in to stop us. We need to see that they actually do their job to protect the voter.
It'd be like, where's Waldo? Where can we find a governor? Tatanka?
Yeah, in addition to security, when we build this sort of movement, remember the role that Vietnam vets played, that veterans played in Standing Rock. And we can call on them to be part of our own security, the nonviolent veterans who basically will stand with us.
Fantastic, a great idea. Hetty Tripp?
Yeah, thanks, Harvey. I'm coming in late, but I just wanted to make sure that folks knew that Keith Ellison's office has put together questions, and Alex is going to be working on some of the answers. So I'm assuming Sluggo will present that at the next meeting, the 22nd, so folks can be ready for the 29th.
Is yours the 22nd? Are you going to present the questions next week, and then we'll have Keith on the week after?
That's a plan.
Yeah, that's a good plan. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyway, that's a great idea. Okay, so we are going to convene. By next week, we will have a plan for a national top level Zoom meeting to organizing meeting and an action oriented meeting to make sure that these two voting rights bills go somewhere. And then we're not waiting and waiting and waiting for the two people from West Virginia and Arizona, but that we move ahead and we get this done. That's a big deal. So 62 people on the call, we should be able to pull together what needs to be done. We cannot allow the decimation of our voting process. Then we are really, really going to have a fascist government. There's no doubt about it. That's exactly the plan. That's Steve Bannon's plan. He's been very clear on it. And I'm glad to see, by the way, that here's another quiz for you. In the world of nonviolence, what is the most effective tool against dictators? The answer, at least from the book I read about the Serbian movement, is ridicule. And if you really want to follow ridicule at its very best, we are getting great service from Saturday Night Live and from Stephen Colbert and from Jimmy Kimmel. These guys are doing a fabulous job of ridiculing our most dangerous people. And I want to applaud them because it's absolutely essential. So let's move forward now. Does anyone else have anything on the Voting Rights Act before we, the two of them, before we move into the climate? Okay, Stephen, if you could show the picture real quick. This is what's known as a major breakthrough. We have the President of the United States actually talking to the Premier, whatever he's called, of China. And what a concept, or as Alec Baldwin called it through Donald Trump, China. But the COP meeting, whatever it was, there they are. The two of them, these two guys, hold the fate of the earth pretty much in our hands here. And I guess they've got kids' books behind them. Okay, that's all I can stand to look at these two guys. But, the COP meeting was what it was. And a lot has come out and a lot hasn't. Ron Leonard, you are our key player in the solar industry. Can you tell us? And Ron, I should say, is in the solar business. He's been in the solar business for a long time. Whenever I want to find out what's happening with solar panels and wind energy, I talk to Ron. I do want, before we get going on this, I did see a couple of very encouraging pieces. Number one, one of the knocks on solar energy is people say it costs you farmland. And what we're finding now is that you put solar panels a little higher on basically on stilts, you actually improve the crops in some locales because a lot of crops actually get too much sun and they grow better under solar panels. And if they grow high enough, they actually cool the solar panels. And it's a win-win situation because solar panels actually produce more electricity when they're cooler. But at the COP meeting, Ron, you followed it very closely. Tell us what the implications are from COP, and then we're going to talk to Mr. O'Neill, Chuck O'Neill, about what's going on in Florida. So go ahead, Ron, please.
So Harvey, you're right. Photovoltaics are a solution that enables farmland and solar to coexist, and the ratio is 1/3 solar, 2/3 crops. And Japanese proved this 2 decades ago. This is no mystery. This is something that we can do right now and have a very good coexistence between energy and crops. And the other coexistence is that farmers get to keep their land and a family farm survives and grows and is substantially improving the quality of the crops that they grow. So
Ron, let me jump in a quick add, because I've been involved in the wind business. Whenever you hear someone saying that windmills take up land, it's a complete lie. And you have met someone who either doesn't know what they're talking about or is an enemy of renewable energy, because even the biggest windmills at the base take up 1 acre. And at most,
maybe
Maybe, right. And they do not take up farmland at all. Beyond that, they actually enhance it. And one other thing, and I can't resist because you raised this, the research is now showing, if you've seen, any of you have seen the movie Seaspiracy about fishing, the research is now showing that if we took one third of the world's oceans, just one third, and made them totally off limits to any fishing, it would sustain the rest of the oceans.
Down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia.
Went digging into the ground.